Hi, I'm Bill Kristol. Welcome back to Conversations. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Whit Ayers, a very respected Republican pollster, analyst, strategist, a longtime friend as well, I should say. And Whit has worked for many distinguished Republicans, many sane Republicans over the years, and helped them get elected. And as Whit joked to me before, that's a shrinking pool now of possible clients. For me, I'd forgotten about this, Whit, until I looked at your bio for a second to remember the name of your firm, which I will now mention, North Star Opinion Research, located here in Northern Virginia. But I'd forgotten that not only were you, went to Davidson College, is that right, I think, which I had the pleasure of teaching a seminar at in 2019, really enjoyed it. B, you have a PhD in political science, so fellow PhD. You taught, fellow former professor. You got tenure, something I never did. And then you'd served for Governor Carol Campbell in South Carolina. Was that your home state, or at least close to your home state?
I've been there a number of years. Yeah, I went to school in North Carolina and then lived in South Carolina, taught in South Carolina, eighth grade, before I went to college, before I went to graduate school.
And, that's tougher than teaching college, right?
Yeah. It is. Oh, toughest job I've ever had. It was a great job, but a tough job. And then I taught college as well before I went to work for Governor.
And then you became Carol Campbell, who really was a great governor of South Carolina, and unfortunately got sick and died at a young age. But he was
really
governor when I was.
A governor can make a difference. A governor can make a difference in a way that no other office other than president can make a real difference. And I'm a big fan of governors.
And you were his budget director, I think.
Budget and policy director,
which is an important job. And I've always forgotten that, but it's, your analysis has always been more substantive, I would say, and more interested in the issues than maybe some of your fellow pollsters and strategists. So maybe that's that background is differentiates you some. Anyway, Whit's one of the most thoughtful analysts of politics generally in America, as well as the Republican Party, and I thought we would take advantage of getting him on here for an hour to find out what do we think. It's August 4th, I guess, after those primaries on August 2nd, and really talk, maybe begin with almost slightly political science discussion almost of what is the current Republican Party in your analysis. I mean, one tends to sort of, if one grew up with a certain vision of the two parties, or in this case, the Republican Party, one tends to assume, well, maybe it's changed a little, but, you know, it's probably going to go back to what it was, and I don't know, it's still recognizable, but you know, if you had a 2014 textbook on American politics, a good one, let's say, that discussed the Republican Party, and this is not his question. I mean, how much of it would still hold? How much of it wouldn't? What parts are most have changed the most, et cetera?
Well, first of all, Bill, it's a real pleasure to be with you. I have read you and admired your analysis for decades now. Hard to say.
Let's not rub that in, you know.
We have both been at this game for quite a few years. The Republican Party today bears little resemblance to the party that you and I first started working for. When I first started my polling firm in 1991, ideologically, the Gold Star category was somewhat conservative. About 45% or so of most electorates, depending on the state, were somewhat conservative. And then about equal proportions, roughly 25% or so, were very conservative or moderate.
Which That's is Republican, why we had the Republican electorate.
Republicans, yeah. Republican electorate. Which is why we had a succession of nominees like George H.W. Bush and Bob Dole and George W. Bush and John McCain and Mitt Romney. They were all out of that somewhat conservative portion of the electorate. But today, it has migrated substantially to the right, so that a typical state Republican Party today will be maybe 45% very conservative, 35% somewhat conservative, and moderates that are down to 10 to 15%. So the party has moved substantially to the right. But beyond that, the party has adopted a completely different tone under Donald Trump than it ever had under George W. Bush, a compassionate conservative. I can't imagine Donald Trump talking about being anything remotely like a compassionate conservative. But all of that is part of the increasing polarization of our politics that goes back decades. I mean, you might start it with the Robert Bork hearings, where the Democrats decided they were not going to let Robert Bork on the Supreme Court. And then we had Newt Gingrich in 1994 with the Gingrich Revolution, fighting wars rather than disagreements with our Democratic colleagues. Democrats responded in kind. You had the Tea Party movement, which was in many ways a precursor to the Trump movement. And then you had Donald Trump taking over the party in 2016. So it's a dramatically different party, far more conservative, far less willing to work across the aisle, far less willing to find common ground, who views Democrats as enemies rather than adversaries. And that's a different world.
Yeah, I guess two questions. How much, it seems like it was a gradual more or less change until about 2015, but I suppose having a nominee and then a elected president who embodies that point of view really changes the dynamics pretty radically. I mean, more so than having some Tea Party members of Congress, but John Boehner or Paul Ryan are still the speaker, right? So, and secondly, and you can sort of weave these two together, obviously, is the nature of the conservatism. I mean, how much is it just, oh, it's two ticks to the right, and how much of it is it's really quite a different mode of thinking about politics in the first place?
Oh, it's a completely different way of thinking. You know, there are a whole lot of people who now want to get elected so that they can get on Fox or OAN or Newsmax and or radio talk shows and get famous rather than make a difference for their constituents, which is kind of what I thought elected office was about. But you're exactly right. I mean, we've had populists throughout American history. I mean, William Jennings Bryan back in the late 1800s. We had Huey Long in the 1930s. We had George Wallace in the 1970s. I mean, a lot of the stuff that you hear coming out of Donald Trump's mouth could have come out of George Wallace's mouth. You know, attacks on the New York Times and these intellectuals who couldn't park a bicycle straight. But it makes a tremendous difference when a populist gets elected president. And we've never had that before in American history, and it has dramatically changed our political culture.
And say a word about the kind of populist, what issues are, you've studied this and you've done polling over the last few years. What issues, what constituencies are key to this wave of Republican populism?
Well, populism is essentially anti. It's anti-elite, and it is for the common man against the corrupt elites. That's the similarity among all populist movements. And the argument is essentially anti. It's anti-intellectual. It's anti-expertise. It's anti-media. It's anti-establishment. In many ways, Brexit in England was the classic populist maneuver. You know, we're against the European Union. We're going to pull out. Well, what's going to happen then? I don't know. We'll figure it out after we get there. And so they blow it up, and here we are, what, 5 years later, they still haven't quite figured it out how they're going to do it. And so populism has a real problem with positive issues and positive visions because it is so consumed by being anti everything that's out there.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Brexit. I was thinking when you said that we've never quite had a real populist as president, I guess Andrew Jackson might be the closest one, really, who ran on something like that. And of course, when you think of, I had never thought about this before, Brexit, his campaign against the Bank of the United States was similar in a sense that it was, we know what we hate, these moneyed elites and taking advantage of the common people. And he did, in fact my history's a little shaky on this, but I believe he got rid of it. And I believe we then had a very bad recession because
and
partly
anti-Indian,
because
anti-Indian.
Yes, and also very much the most pro-slavery and sort of racist president we'd had at that point, I think, really the first to become kind of almost pro-slavery as opposed to just we have to tolerate it for now kind of attitude, and as you say, really dismissing any notion that you should be decent to Native Americans. And yeah, no, it is interesting that the Bank of the United States and Brexit is sort of a similar thing with, we don't quite know what we want to replace it with, except, you know, people should have their own currency or something and not have this terrible bank. I've heard you at other times talk about I mean, you mentioned the current polling, which is very interesting. If just self-identified, what you're saying is that, what, almost half the party is very conservative, and and then 35% somewhat conservative, and then a smaller bunch of moderates. I've heard you divide the party up, also in terms of Trump, though, right? And or in terms of...
Because Trump is not fundamentally an ideological movement. It is a populist movement, which... Our traditional terms of what's conservative don't really apply that way. I mean, he's sort of taken over the term, but it doesn't mean what it used to mean. We have basically three elements of the Republican Party today, and this is based upon things like favorable ratings and attitudes about job approval for Donald Trump. Basically, you got a never Trump faction of people who still consider themselves Republicans, but they never supported Trump. They didn't vote for him. They did not approve of his job performance. That's somewhere around 10%. You've got an always Trump faction, which is somewhere around 30%. And that's a group of people for whom Donald Trump hung the moon. They will walk through a wall of flame for Donald Trump. And criticizing Donald Trump for among these people is like criticizing Jesus in a rural evangelical church. You know, that Jesus guy just wasn't all he was cracked up to be. I guarantee you it would change no views about Jesus in the evangelical church, but it would certainly change the views about the person who criticized Jesus in the evangelical church. And that's the way these always Trump people view anyone who criticizes Donald Trump. Then we've got the largest block, which I call maybe Trump people, you know, somewhere around 60% or so. These are people who are very protective of Trump. They're very defensive of Trump. They voted for him twice. They approve of his job performance, but they're not totally convinced that they want him to run for president again in 2024. They would certainly vote for him over Joe Biden if that was the choice again. But Trump was so controversial. I mean, Trump created tensions in marriages, certainly tensions among siblings, certainly tensions between children and parents. And if they could get somebody who they think would do many of the things that Donald Trump has done without the controversy, without the baggage, they are at least open to considering that person. I'm not saying they wouldn't go for Trump, because they might, but they're at least open to considering that individual. Sarah Longwell's done some great focus groups with people who you can start to see that dynamic working a little bit. So the real question is, how many of those people are going to end up in Trump's camp, assuming he runs for president again? The 30% is always going to be there. But keep in mind, Donald Trump didn't do a lot better than 30% in the early primaries either. You know, South Carolina, he got 35%. You know, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz got about 25 each. So if you split up the non-Trump vote among 16 or 17 people, 35% goes a long way with winner-take-all primaries. So essentially 10, 30, 60 in round numbers, I think is where the party is today. And the January 6th hearings may have increased that 60% somewhat.
Yeah, that's interesting. I want to come right back to that, because that's so interesting going forward. And you'll stay on the Republican Party for a bit, and then we can talk more broadly about American politics today. But just on the issue mix for 1 minute, you know, what you said about the populism is, I think, important. I there's a piece by Umberto Eco, the more famously known as a novelist, from about almost 30 years ago on fascism. So this is not populism, but it's certainly a step or two over from populism. But he makes a very important point, I think, that those of us who sort of grew up thinking about communism and Nazism, even, you know, totalitarian movements that had a more or less coherent ideology, for all that they didn't always follow it and so forth, sort of miss something about fascism, which is that it's incoherent. It's psychological, it's cultural, it hates certain things and opposes certain things. But it can change in certain on particular issues. Mussolini was sort of anti-clerical at the beginning and then went into an alliance with the church and decided, okay, I'm no longer so, you know, much worrying about that. I'm not such a modernist. I'm more of a yearning for the past kind of guy. But he combined the both the appeal to, you know, fake kind of history from 2000 years ago and a kind of modernism and post-liberalism, you know, at the same time. And I guess that's true of populism too in some ways. So but which of those parts of it are most, you know, essential or key? I mean, I guess what I'm really putting is for the 60%, how much of it is now, how many of their views on some issues, immigration to take an obvious one, or maybe some of the social issues, trade, foreign policy. I mean, there are a whole bunch of issues that people look at Trump and think, well, he has this view on that, this view on that. I very much agree that those views are secondary in some respect. On the other hand, they're not nothing, I guess, right? And they've also been propagated now for 5 or 6 years and by Trump and by followers of Trump. And so they have, how much have they sunk in? I mean, for that 60% going forward, how much do you have to be sort of Trumpy on policy, if I can put it that way? And how much do you just have to have a certain attitude, have to not be an anti-Trump, certainly, have a certain disdain for liberal elites, and have more flexibility on the issues?
Well, an awful lot of it is affect and loss tone and culture and against woke liberalism. Donald Trump did have a platform in 2016, which was very different from a lot of Republicans in the past. I mean, it was strongly anti-immigrant. You know, I mean, George W. Bush reached out to Hispanic voters in Texas and managed to get 44% of the Hispanic vote in 2004, which is a high watermark for Republican presidential contenders in at least forever. And Donald Trump changed a lot of Republican views to make it more anti-immigrant. Not that it wasn't there before, but he made it more anti-immigrant. He diminished the percentage of people who think that college educations are important. He increased the proportion of Republicans who had a favorable view of Vladimir Putin. I mean, there's a lot of movement on issues within the Republican coalition to follow Donald Trump and take Trumpian positions on those issues that would never have come out of the mouth of George W. Bush, for example, or John McCain or Mitt Romney.
So on this, I mean, do this thought experiment for me, and then we'll talk a little bit concretely about Trump and the alternatives in 23-24. But, I mean, could a Republican who wanted to appeal to that 60% say, look, I love Donald Trump. I mean, I respect him. He was right. When he ran, it was very important to have this real tough attitude. There was terrorism on Muslim immigrants and wariness about the border. And I'm with him on the border. We need to build that wall. But, you know, the economy, we need some workers here. And we need good immigrants and legal immigrants. Not illegal, but good, you know, legal immigrants. And we need them. I don't know how far you want to go. And then the candidate might want to go in this. We need both the high-end ones to help invent things, and, you know, start businesses and occupy, become programmers. I'm caricaturing here, sort of, you know, in Silicon Valley. And we need also immigrants who are coming here to begin ascending the economic ladder from the bottom. And they'll work in restaurants and hotels and so forth. So Trump was right, but we need to make a bit of an adjustment here. Would that be palatable, or is that a bridge too far, in your opinion?
It works among independents. Works really well among independents. We won't know until somebody tries it, Bill. But using reason and logic and saying things like immigrants are more likely to start businesses that create jobs for Americans, those are the kinds of things that appeal to reason. And an awful lot of the position on immigration has a lot more to do with emotion and culture than it does with reason. I'd like to see somebody try that, but I don't know how successful it would be.
So I think if one were advising, you wouldn't be probably, but, you know, a Trump adjacent candidate, let's just say, for 2023 and 4, maybe don't be as harsh as Trump. You don't have to go full Monty, I suppose, in terms of Mexican rapists and no Muslims being admitted, but you don't challenge, in a sense. I suppose the same might be true, you know, the Trump sentiments too directly. I suppose the same might be true on foreign policy. You don't have to be dismissive of NATO or pro-Putin, but you don't go around pointing out that people who are dismissive of NATO have been proven wrong, and NATO accession is really a very good thing for Sweden and Finland and so forth, right? And I guess that's the. Do you think that's the sort of the thing they'll try to straddle? I mean,
the model is Glenn Youngkin, who managed to walk that line fairly successfully in his race for Virginia governor. He talked about issues that were really important to people, particularly education in the midst of the pandemic. And he took positions that sounded sort of like Trump, but weren't out of the Trump playbook. And he never went as far as to say Joe Biden wasn't a legitimately elected president, for example. But he talked about issues that appealed to a lot of center-right voters and center-right parents, and walked the Trumpian line very successfully, I thought, which is one reason why he won.
But he was running for governor, not for federal office, right? It's harder to do if you're running for Senate or House or President.
And it's so much easier for gubernatorial candidates to separate themselves from the national environment than it is candidates for the House or the Senate.
But not separate themselves too much in terms of the party. So yeah, Youngkin or DeSantis, I guess, is certainly a click over in terms of being willing to sound Trumpy on some issues, but also a governor, right? I guess maybe that's not an accident.
Exactly. And Ron DeSantis has done some things on the environment and attacking the red tide and that sort of thing that were very important to the tourist industry that are not typical of what you'd think of as a conservative governor.
So let's be concrete going forward. I mean, do you tend to think Trump runs in 20 for next runs again?
Bill, I have no idea. I take him at his word, and his word is he's running.
Yeah.
So, but there's so many things that could intervene between now and then, legally, in terms of health, all kinds of stuff. But I take him at his word that he's running.
And if he runs, he has, let's just say, that 30% to start with, which on the one hand is, as you say, doesn't put you over the top, but it also gives you very high base. If you can peel off 10% of the other 60, 20%, of course, of the other 60, you're at a majority.
He will have a base that's much higher than any other candidate in the field.
And I guess historically, but who knows if historical, rules or precedents matter anymore, that's usually enough to get you elected. And that is the way you win a nomination in the Republican Party in particular, though to some degree in both, is you have a bigger base to start with. Which you've run before in many cases, the McCain, Romney, right, or Bush for the family name. So, and then you don't need to win over all the others, and other people run a pretty good race against you sometimes, Lamar Alexander in 96 against Dole, or, McCain against Bush in 2000, but it's not enough to kind of get over that initial advantage, you might say.
That's right. And the election rules really matter, too. The Democrats are far more likely to use proportional representation, where if you get 30% of the vote, you get 30% of the delegates in that state. Republicans are much more likely to do winner-take-all primaries. And so you get 35%, one more than the next guy, and you get all the delegates from that state. And let's not underestimate the extent to which Donald Trump has taken control of the RNC. In many ways, he has control over the referees, and they may very well determine that some people don't belong on a debate stage or aren't reasonable candidates for a Republican nomination. I'm thinking about Liz Cheney if she were to run. I'm not at all convinced that the RNC would let her on a debate stage with Donald Trump. So there are a lot of factors that have to go into that consideration. But yes, you're right. He starts off with 30, and that is a higher base than anybody else.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point about Liz Cheney. I've been thinking about that a little bit recently. Everyone just assumes that, we know how these things work. They've worked in a certain way for 40 years. There are debates, which are usually moderated by mainstream journalists. So each party might pick people a little more to their taste, but it's still not, it's real debate. And the people who are above 3% or 5% or 10% in the polls, whatever the cutoff is, or have raised X amount of money, get to be on stage. And of course, there's always a little bit of putting thumbs on the scale, but it's more or less a kind of somewhat fair process, you might say. And why do we assume that for 20, 24, though. I mean,
in the Trump era, we cannot assume that just because things have always been done that way, that they will be done that way in the future. We can't assume that anymore.
And you've been around the RNC for quite a while, and you know a lot of the people on it and close to it. You do think that he controls it. It's not just that they're not friendly to Never Trumpers. It's that they're actually loyal to him personally.
Yes, I do. And as well as state parties. I mean, he's done a very, very good job of taking over the state parties. I mean, why do you think the state parties go out censoring people who vote to impeach Donald Trump?
Yeah.
He has very, very thorough control of the RNC and state parties around the country.
Which means that in some key states in the primary process, it's not so obvious. I'm presuming they're not going to stop Ron DeSantis or Glenn Youngkin from being on the ballot, but the Liz Cheney, Larry Hogan, the notion that you could run a symbolic campaign, but still get on the debate stage, make a difference, force some of the other candidates to confront January 6th, the things that I would be thinking Liz Cheney advisor would be thinking ahead about, well, this is why it's useful to run, even if you probably don't, of course, don't win. Some of those things start to become questionable, right?
I mean, Exactly. I mean, keep in mind that a lot of primaries were simply canceled in 2020. You know, it's like, you know, we've got the president. We're not going to run primaries. We didn't adopt a platform because something on the platform might disagree with Donald Trump. So a lot of things that typically happened, you know, you have primaries, even if you had a president of that party, just ask Lyndon Johnson, didn't happen in 2020. And we traditionally had a platform. It didn't happen in 2020. So a lot of things have changed.
I mean, one would think that his not being an incumbent president would restore sort of a little more of a competitive situation. But I suppose that's an interesting question going forward. Yeah. Do you assume, on the other hand, that people do run? That, I mean, DeSantis, Young, some combination of Pence,
sure.
DeSantis, Youngkin, Pompeo, Cotton, Cruz, that do think this is their chance and run. They're not all deterred. If Trump announces it's on Labor Day, I'm running to try to, in a way, stop slight anti-Trump momentum, if there is some, and, freeze the field and intimidate people a little. Do you think it works, or do you think that serious people still think this is their chance and are willing to take on Trump directly?
I think there are a lot of people willing to take on Trump. I mean, Mike Pence is obviously out there doing so right now. Ron DeSantis has played it well, I thought, not even talking about running for president, but he's sure laying a foundation to run a very, very competitive race. So, sure, I don't think Trump clears the field at all.
And even if he announces early and all that, it doesn't deter someone like DeSantis, who's governor of a huge state, or Pence and so forth.
No.
Yeah, that does. I mean, that we haven't seen that. I mean, we saw in 2015-16, of course, but we haven't seen for seven, we won't have seen for 7-8 years, really, what it's like for Trump to actually have challengers who are, much as I love Joe Walsh and Bill Weld, not, symbolic Never Trump standard bearers, but actual Republicans who've been elected and real states, or in Trump's case, been served as vice president in the Trump era, right? I think that's something we just don't, it sort of will test the proposition of how much it's Trump's party, how much it's a Trumpist party, how much, if you don't repudiate Trump and sort of embrace a fair amount of the Trumpism, you get to be possibly the heir to Trump, right? I guess we don't really know that, do we?
No. And I don't think we can know that until we know what the environment's like in late 2023.
And so what do you maybe that answers the question. I was going to say, what do you think we've learned from the primaries this year? But maybe whatever we've learned is sort of temporary. But we have learned something, presumably, from watching these different races of different varieties of Trumpism and Trump embracers and slightly different results in different states. But what's your general take on what's happened?
Well, Trump is still a force to be reckoned with. He's not the be-all and end-all, but a Trump endorsement can help elevate a candidate who's relatively close over the finish line, whether it's Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania or J.D. Vance in Ohio. But when you have someone like Brian Kemp in Georgia with his own independent reputation, he governed as a conservative, he didn't come out against Donald Trump, he simply wouldn't overturn the election for him. He had his own base, and he was very successful running on the record that he had already established. So the Trump endorsement is certainly helpful, but it's hardly the be-all, end-all for a candidate. You can't take a candidate who's not running a good race and doesn't have some kind of base and vault him into a victory, especially against a well-known, well-liked incumbent like Brian Kemp.
Yeah, Kemp would seem to be the strongest argument for a certain amount of liberation from Trump going forward for the Republican Party. Kemp voted for Trump twice, and he professes loyalty to Trump, even as Trump attacked him in 2022, and says he'll vote for him again if he's the nominee and so forth. But is that what if Kemp decided to run for president? Is he a tick too? Will the apostasy of 2020 be a showstopper for him?
It creates some issues. I keep thinking about other governors like Ron DeSantis, how lucky he was that Trump won Florida. Hmm. Because if Biden had won Florida, Ron DeSantis would have the same problems Brian Kemp has. So he was just really, really fortunate that that Trump managed to win Florida.
So just evading the 2020 question and the big lie about it subsequently, and not having to have confronted it might be enough for a Republican candidate.
Bill, a majority of Republicans still believe the election was stolen.
Right.
A majority of Republicans do not believe that Donald Trump instigated the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. Those views are pretty solid right now, and they haven't moved a whole lot in the last year.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. That is striking, right? You'd think January 6th might have shaken the character of the Republican Party, just its views on certain things. But I would say everything you've been saying here, which I think is very enlightening and accurate, we haven't even mentioned January. January 6th didn't change it. Didn't change much, right? We'd be having the same conversation if there had been no riot on January 6th, and there had been, and the plot to overturn the election had been much less systematic, and there hadn't been the fake electors, and he had just been unhappy and sullen and unpleasant to Biden and so forth, but had just gone away. It's amazing, isn't it? To me at least, that it doesn't seem to have changed much in our analysis about the party.
Well, I think that it's a mistake to assume the January 6th hearings had no effect whatsoever on Republicans. It's kind of an article of faith among Republicans that they paid no attention to it whatsoever. Didn't look at it, didn't read anything about it. But some of the testimony has been so compelling and so vivid that it kind of seeps into the water. And what it does, I think, is increase, however modestly, the proportion of people in that maybe Trump faction that say, I'm not sure I want to go through all of that again. So it's not going to affect Trump's job approval among Republicans. It's not going to affect his favorable rating among Republicans. But the January 6th hearings may have some effect on the proportion of Republicans who would really like to see him run again.
And maybe a disproportionate effect among Republican elites and donors and so forth?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. More so among Republican elites and donors than Republican voters.
Yeah. But essentially, I was talking with someone who works for one of those Republican donors, and it's like, well, we don't want Trump. We want DeSantis or Youngkin or whatever. We're open to all these people, and we want to meet with them. And I said, well, the guy you're working for say that he doesn't want Trump? Not so sure about that. No need to pick a fight, And he could be the nominee. It's 50-50 that he's the nominee. I don't know if it is 50. Is that about right, 50-50? Yeah, I think. What do you think?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Depends on what happens between now and the primaries.
Yeah.
And a lot could happen between now and the primaries.
But even if it's 50-50 now that he's nominee, at least, we can't afford to pick a fight. I was sort of struck that there's that. And you do wonder does that mean, fine, if they give money to DeSantis or Youngkin, they become very credible and they have money and they run. But on the other hand, if they're not willing to publicly ever push back against Trump, I don't know if an awful lot of Republican voters like, I don't know, why don't we just nominate Trump again? He did win, in 2016. And they say he won in 2020.
Bill, the mindset of other Republicans was summed up well by my friend Tom Cole, the very well-respected congressman from Oklahoma. He told me way back some years ago that Trump got 69% in his district and Tom got 73%. He said, if I get in a fight with Donald Trump, I'm pretty sure he'll keep his 69 and I'll keep my 4. And that's sort of the mindset of Republican elected officials in the Trump era.
I mean, I want to dwell on that a minute because I think it's so interesting and revealing. And I never heard this particular conversation with Tom before. So I've known Tom an awful long time too, and respect him. And was shocked when he voted to overturn to reject the electors on January 6th.
Yeah, so was I.
147.
And he was disappointed.
Disappointed. And he was asked about it in Oklahoma. And said something, look, if my district is so overwhelmingly in this direction, then I'm going to go along. And he also implicitly said, I knew it wasn't going to matter and, you know, it wasn't going to happen and so forth. But this is where I was turned out to be wrong, I think, in early 2017, where I still had more hopes for Republican, the party on the Hill, liberating itself from Trump and just being, you know, a check on Trump, as well as going along with the things they agreed on, obviously. And I remember saying in most more states than not, the Republicans ran ahead of Trump for Senate, if I'm not mistaken, in 2016 in some of these key states.
Far ahead. Marco Rubio won the Senate by 8 points. Trump won it by 1 in Florida. A lot of the difference were Hispanics who voted for Rubio who didn't vote for Trump. Rob Portman went way ahead of Trump in Ohio. But Toomey in Pennsylvania, Burr in North Carolina, almost all the Senate candidates, Republican Senate candidates who won, ran ahead of Trump.
So I mistakenly assumed that they would therefore assume I have some freedom or leverage. These people voted Republican because they're Republicans and they didn't like Hillary Clinton and they were sick 8 years of Obama and so forth. And so I can sort of be both supportive and a check. But I didn't appreciate the point, what Tom Cole did, in fact. I think he was right and I was wrong. And so, I mean, you could say to Cole, that's a little ridiculous. You've got 73% of the vote. What are you so panicked about Trump for? But he understood that Trump's hold on his 69% was qualitatively different from Tom Cole's hold on his 73%, right?
And that exactly. Exactly. That's a good way to put it.
And I don't know quite, and they saw that quickly, some of the elected officials, was they were talking to all their voters, their constituents, I suppose. And it became clear in the course of 2017-18 how true that was, right? And that's why, for me, the Republican Party by 2019 was pretty different from even 2017-18. There was just the degree of just collapse, discrediting any notion of opposing Trump on anything, basically, or almost anything. It was much stronger by 2019 than I thought it might have been in 2017. You know, then in 2017, I think there was still some question about that.
Right. No, yeah. I completely agree. It's continued to change.
And it's continued. That's the other thing. And then of January 6th, I thought, okay, maybe we'll at least get back to 2017, if I can put it that way. They're not going to be like me on Trump, but they will be wrong. It's a big fact, though. You know, we take it for granted now because it happened and, you know, we're living with it. But the degree to which that, I don't know, could it have happened if more people had voted to impeach and if McConnell had decided, let's convict him and take him off the stage, disqualifying him to run again, or that it just led to a bigger blow up and more hostility among Trump supporters to the Republican establishment? I guess we'll never know, right?
Yeah, exactly. Buddha could have, should have. I don't know.
The establishment acquiescence to Trump is, don't you think, very important, though? That is to say, the history of the last 5-6 years of a Trump with a loyal faction of the party, but with pretty consistent pushback from senators, governors, members of Congress, and changes the dynamic a little. He's still powerful. He's president of the United States. But I don't know. Maybe it was inevitable, but it feels to me like the fact that the party ended up utterly embracing him and acquiescing to him and even subjecting itself to him, you might say, it feels to me like that really did change the dynamic. Maybe it was there from the beginning. I don't know.
No. I think you're exactly right. It completely changed the dynamic. I mean, that's a point that Levitsky and Zablatt make in their book, How Democracies Die, that there have always been kind of populist people with some authoritarian tendencies, but it was the parties and the elites that were the ones that kept them from getting too far in politics. And when the party basically goes along with whatever you want and eliminates primaries and eliminates platforms, That is a huge, huge advantage to any politician, and particularly to Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that the Republican Party being his party is almost a bigger fact than him being him, you know, at this point. But yeah, they're very related to each other. What about, let's just say, a word on 2022? I mean, you're, of course, an analyst. You've been through many of these midterms, not leaving Trump aside, but just stepping back from the Republican Party. Where are you on the spectrum of 2022 looks awfully good for Republicans? Historically, it always has been good for the out party, too. Maybe it's different this year. There's a decoupling of the congressional generic ballot and the Biden approval rating, et cetera. What's your sense of that?
As you said, President's party almost always loses seats in the first midterm. That did not occur with George W. Bush in 2002 because of 9/11. But almost always, the President's party loses seats. But the job approval of that president is absolutely critical. When a president has had job approval above 50%, the average loss of seats in the House is 14, average of 14. When it's below 50%, the average loss is 37 seats. So there's a very clear pattern of seat loss related to job approval, and Joe Biden is down at 41%. I mean, light years away from 50 right now. So it's very difficult to see how the Republicans don't take over the House in 2022. The Senate's a completely different matter. I mean, Senate candidates are more independent from the broader environment, as we were just talking about with the Senate Republicans running ahead of Trump in 2016. You know, how is Blake Masters going to do against Mark Kelly? I mean, Herschel Walker does not look like he's ready for prime time. Now, the half of my office that are dyed-in-the-wool Georgia Bulldogs will get really upset with me for saying anything negative about Herschel Walker. Trust me, I mean, these are kids who grew up with Herschel Walker jerseys, you know, going to football games at the University of Georgia. But it does not appear that Herschel Walker is exactly the All-American candidate that he was the All-American football player. You know, how is Adam Laxalt going to do against Senator Masto? How is J.D. Vance going to do against Tim Ryan? I mean, Tim Ryan's running at him from the right almost right now, you know, talking about, you know, protectionism and trade and that sort of thing. How's Dr. Oz going to do against John Fetterman? There's so many candidates out there that look like they're not quite ready for prime time that it's difficult at this point to make a firm determination on which party is likely to control the Senate after the midterms.
So I
think Republicans have left, you know, half a dozen Senate seats on the table since 2010 by nominating not ready for primetime candidates.
It's a senator.
I'm not
just
a witch in Delaware, for example.
Right. Yeah, and a huge wave election, right? I mean, I think it's polarization, probably, and redistricting reduce that average of House seats a sum, right? Because it just isn't, you're not going to have the kind of swings we had in 2010, I don't think.
Exactly. But, I mean, Republicans won so many seats they weren't supposed to win in 2020 that there are not that many seats out there for them to win. But I think there were certainly enough out there for them to take control of the House after the midterms.
But senators do differentiate themselves, obviously, especially if there's massive advertising spent on both sides. People know who their Senate candidates are. House is a little more of a generic party vote, and presumably, as you say. But you do believe, just to finish up on the House, that the Biden approval matters. You can't make it a choice between Republican extremism in general and Democrats being okay in general, that it does become you still believe in the referendum on the president argument, basically, on the House.
Yes. Yep. I mean, that you got to do something to change that. Now, if Donald Trump announces he's running for president before the midterms, that will give Democrats a real boost, because then they have a more credible argument that this is a choice election. But, you know, barring that, it looks like it's going to be a referendum on the Biden administration and Democratic governance, and it's not going to go well.
You think Trump announcing would change things pretty substantially, though? Could.
Who knows how much, but it would certainly give the Democrats a talking point that they don't now have.
But Senate and candidates, and I suppose governor candidates even more, are known to the voters, distinguish themselves, as it were, from the parties. The voters make more of a choice, and it's a little less of just, I don't like this party, so I like this party. I mean, it still is for most voters. They just vote the party they're in. But for some non-trivial chunk of voters, it's actually a real choice, not just a ratification, as it were, of a party.
Yeah, I mean, governors actually make life and death decisions. You know, in states with capital punishment, they have the final call on that. They make determinations about whether to evacuate a coast in the event of a hurricane. I mean, there's a certain element of competence that you look for in a governor that you don't care about that much in a senator or congressman, because governors truly do make life and death decisions.
Yeah, senators and congressmen are one vote out of 100 or 435.
Right. Exactly.
To some degree, I mean. And for all the talk about how there are no swing voters anymore and everyone's just a partisan, I mean, in real time, right now, it's in the same poll, the same surveys of the same citizens, we've got, Kemp up 5, 6, 7 over Stacey Abrams in Georgia, and mm-hmm. Walker down 4, 5, 6 maybe to Warnock, it looks like, which means, 5% of the voters are, right now, Kemp-Warnock voters. And 5% isn't huge, but it's certainly enough to make Kemp plus 5 and make Warnock plus 5, right? I mean,
sure, exactly.
So, exactly. Was that 10% of the voters? Maybe my math's no good, but the swing there in real can happen in states and between House districts and gubernatorial candidates and so forth. It can happen the other way too. It can happen that you vote for your Republican for Congress, but then you can't vote for Mastriano or something like that for governor, I suppose, right? So, I mean, think that, and that's not, so for all the polarization, there's still enough voters to make these results distinctive in at least a good, some chunk of states, maybe some states are so far. Yeah.
No, based on the polling you just mentioned in Georgia, by definition, that's enough to swing a race that's likely to be a 1 or 2 or 3 point race.
Yeah, that's interesting. We're talking, 2 days? It's August 4th after the Kansas referendum, which was pretty startling, 59-41, on the no side of changing the current constitutional interpretation of Kansas's constitution to permit pretty broad abortion rights. Can an issue like that, I won't say come out of nowhere, but come out of the Supreme Court and then this is Kansas sort of giving it a shot in the arm, could that change the dynamics? Or is this sort of, 3 months from now, we'll look back at the gloves, that was an interesting referendum, but most of the races are still playing out the way we would have expected a couple of months ago.
It certainly energized Democrats to come out and vote, or at least pro-choice people to come out and vote, which included a number of Republicans.
Yeah.
And it did give a shot in the arm to a Democratic electorate that was otherwise pretty discouraged and lethargic. And we're going to have lots of debates in state legislatures now about abortion that we would never have had before. I'm one of those who thinks that we would have been better off for many years having the state legislatures adopt different abortion policy depending on the culture of that state, rather than have the Supreme Court trying to mandate one solution for the entire country. But we've got some pretty roiling debates that are going to go on. Bill, I'm convinced, given the enormous moral and ethical issues involved in abortion, that our kids and grandkids are going to be arguing about abortion. I don't think it's going away. The vast majority of Americans think abortion ought to be legal in some circumstances, but not others. The vast majority. And then we're going to argue about what circumstances under which it should be legal. And I don't think that's going away. It's not going to be like gay marriage, for example, where the issue is basically done. You've got majorities of Americans who now support gay marriage, including majorities of Republicans. It's a sea change, an absolute sea change. And the numbers on gay marriage look a lot like the numbers on interracial marriage. Back when we were in elementary school, a grand total of 4% of Americans believed it should be legal for black people to marry white people. And those numbers crossed in the 80s, and now people look at you like you're nuts if you say there was once a time during my lifetime where it was illegal for a black person to marry a white person. We're going to reach a point before too long where the people will look with the same incredulity at you when you say there was a point at which a gay person could not marry another gay person in America. That argument is over and done, but abortion will never be over and done, I don't think.
Interesting. But for now, Republicans seem to have, you can talk about this a little maybe, I mean, gotten themselves into a more extreme, Democrats have some extreme views on abortion if you penetrate a little bit and push them hard. They're not where Clinton was. They're not for really making it rare, you could argue. But it's more visibly the case that Republicans have gotten themselves pretty far out on a limb where they weren't when you and I worked in pro-life administrations at the national and state level. I think it was pretty routine to be for exceptions. It was pretty routine to be for, certainly for life of the mother, and then the health of the mother was always a little controversial because it could be kind of open-ended, but there was always some understanding even of that, I think. That awful lot of candidates now seem to me to have, I mean, if you're running for governor especially, in a state, I think it's very much different state by state, right? But if you're running to be a Democratic governor, let's say Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan, in a state that does have a Republican legislature, where the Republican nominee has said at least that she's for banning abortion in all cases. That's a pretty, you know, it's a real thing. I mean, it's not just a cultural talking point. Gretchen Whitmer can say honestly in her ads, if you don't elect me, you really run the risk of extremely restrictive abortion restrictions here in Michigan. This is not like casting a vote, you know, for what you like in general about, you know, this issue. This is a real choice. Now, some states don't have a real choice because the state's either solidly one way or the other, or if you're running for federal office, that's less of a choice. Though even there, I wonder how much you could make it, to the degree the Republicans are unwilling to say they don't want national legislation, that they want national legislation, or some Republicans say it, or Kevin McCarthy won't say it, he doesn't want it. It could even become a voting issue at the national level. I feel like people are a little bit underestimating how potent it could be in some states, in some districts, but maybe not in some races and not others, you know?
I agree completely. I mean, politically, as a candidate, if you're going to talk about abortion at all, you want to focus on the extreme views of the other side. So Republicans want to talk about partial birth abortion, and do you think that should be legal? And the Democrats want to talk about abortion under no circumstances. But I tell you, if you are in a position where you say you should not be allowed to have an abortion in the case of rape or incest, or in some cases, even the life of the mother, you are a tiny, tiny minority position in this country. I mean, most Americans, a vast, vast majority, over 90%, reject that position on abortion.
And if you're running for governor, voters might think you could actually do something about it. So it's in your state.
Exactly.
So I've always thought people underestimate, you know, people, it's fashionable, the economy, kitchen table, that's much more important than abortion. But I don't know, you know, if people think it's real, that becomes a different thing than just I dislike what that person is saying, but of course it's not going to affect the actual laws, which was kind of the status of the abortion debate, for better or worse, really, you know, for almost 50 years, right? The court resolved it. So
I was just going to say, what the Supreme Court has done is raise abortion up on the list of most important issues among Democrats, so that it is one of the very top issues now among Democratic voters.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I think people who are friends who, you know, it's just so used to sort of, it's an important issue for the base, parts of the base of each parties, but it doesn't really move many voters because they kind of don't really believe in pro-life center or pro-choice center or something like that. It's like Hyde Amendment, but it's kind of marginal. And even at the state level, of course, I think that's, yeah, the salience of the issue, I guess, as they say, really seems much greater because it's sort of real in a way that, I remember having this argument with someone a few months ago, saying, oh, inflation's big. What, do people really believe that a governor's going to do anything about inflation? I mean, it's bad for Biden, obviously, and it's bad for the Democrats, therefore. On the other hand, I don't know, some Democratic Republican governor candidate going to say, I'm going to reduce inflation, I'll be fine, but what does it really mean? Whereas suddenly you're looking at an issue where, especially if there's already a Republican legislature, depending if what law's already on the books, as in Wisconsin, you know, you suddenly becomes like, whoa, this is really something that will affect my life or my, you know, kids' lives or my friends' lives, you know, conceivably in the next 4 years. I think that issue's been, Kansas has been the wake-up call, obviously, and no one's underestimating it now, but maybe not many people are, but I think it was underestimated in the immediate aftermath of Roe. There was a little bit of, you know, they've lanced the boil, and now we're going to have a healthy debate about it and over the next 5 years. Well, maybe I hope we do, but in 50 states. But for now, we also can have very heated. It was introduced into a very polarized environment, right? I mean,
right, exactly.
Might have been healthier.
Exactly. We're
going to
have a debate. We'll see if it's healthy.
Yeah. No. That's a. Yeah. That's unfortunate for the country, but sound analytical point. And just on the Democrats, looking at it from outside. Does Biden? I mean, I've been strongly of the view that Biden shouldn't run again, but I guess I think he won't. But I don't know. Maybe I'm just wrong. What do you think? Does he run again? Should he run again? If you were the master of the Democratic Party, what's the strongest Democratic ticket in 2024?
Somebody other than Joe Biden at the top of it.
Yeah, that's what I think too. And don't Democrats that you talk to think that as well?
Oh, sure. Of course. I mean, and you can back that up with polling. I mean, some 80% of Democrats don't want Joe Biden to run again. And it's not so much a negative judgment on Joe Biden among Democrats as it is just a judgment on a guy who's, you know, going to be over 80 years old. Most people think you ought to have somebody younger. You know, there's some interesting Democratic governors out there. Polis in Colorado looks interesting. Klobuchar ran a good race. She's from the right part of the country. Smartest guy they've got is Pete Buttigieg, but I don't know if you can elect a guy president who kissed his husband on a public stage. They've got some interesting folks out there, but there's nobody who jumps out as an obvious alternative, and it's certainly not Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I was about to say, you didn't mention the actual vice president, who normally would be the first person you would mention if the incumbent president were not going to run again.
Not ready for prime time. I remember her trying to explain her health care plan back during her primary campaign, and she was getting so twisted around in knots, I found myself thinking, listen, just get Pete Buttigieg to explain your health care plan. He can do a better job of it than you can, I guarantee you.
I mean, if there's a wide open Democratic race, which I personally would sort of like to see and have a maybe slightly wishful view that it will be healthy and the better candidates will emerge, and maybe it's Klobuchar or Buttigieg or Polis or whoever, both better and more moderate candidates and fresh faces, but also with enough experience. But I could be just kidding myself. Maybe it's a wide open race and it looks like the Democratic debates of 2019 with no Biden to come in and save them at the end. And it's just a mess. And incidentally, the left is pretty strong and you don't end up with an electable moderate Democrat. Do you have a view on that? Or I guess it's either possible.
Well, the energy in both parties is at the extremes. But the electorate is not at the extremes. I mean, if you look at Gallup data, 37% of Americans say they're moderate, and then declining proportions become somewhat liberal, very liberal, somewhat conservative, very conservative, which is one reason why we have this ping pong government, because the parties get in and they run to their bases, to the right in the Republicans and the left in the Democrats, and yet most Americans are somewhere within shouting distance of the center. So one party gets control of the government and then the electorate comes along and throws them out. Throughout the Republicans in 2006, Democrats in 2010, throughout the Republicans in 2018, we're about ready to throw out the Democrats in 2022. I'm convinced if one party could get control of the government and not govern from the extremes, that they might actually govern for a while. But we haven't had an example of that in quite a while.
It's interesting. And you stressed early on that, you know, the actual self-identified very conservative, somewhat conservative, had changed quite a lot within the Republican electorate.
Dramatically.
But not so much among the public. I mean, that is, there's been a separation into the two parties, but the overall bell curve, if that's the right word, holds with the public.
Exactly. I mean, the public remains somewhere close to the center. Pew Research has these moving mountains, which are very vivid among the median Republican, the median Democrat. And back when we first started in this game, the mountains were pretty close together. And now they're being separated by an increasing gulf as the parties move to the extremes, which is one reason why people are so dissatisfied with the federal government, so dissatisfied with the direction of the country, and so dissatisfied with the people who are in office. They're not governing where most people are.
And this is the argument for independent candidates and third parties. And do you think there's any greater chance of that happening than there has been for most of our life?
If it's Trump-Biden as our choices in 2024, the vacuum in the middle is going to be absolutely extraordinary. But we have such a bias, structural bias, toward the two parties. It's just difficult to see a third party or an independent candidate getting that far off the ground. But what's happened more often in American politics is that one of the two major parties has absorbed a third party or absorbed this disparate movement, a protest movement within it, rather than building it up as a competitor to one of the two major parties. If a very popular former president like Teddy Roosevelt can't make a go of it as a third party, it's hard to imagine someone who's not been a former president being successful as a third party run.
Yeah, I do think Trump, Biden, or even maybe worse, so Trump, AOC, I mean, you know, really radical Trump Elizabeth Warren, let's just say it that way.
Trump Sanders.
Yeah, Trump Sanders, which really, you know, it's not like Sanders was that far from winning in 2020, the nomination. Right. That really does seem like the rules are biased against, of course, an independent or third party, but at some point, celebrity plus money, you could get a bit of a Macron situation, I guess, and even as early as 24. But on the other hand, the history and the structures are so against it. And such a fear, I think, on the part of center-left anti-Trump types, and I would put myself in this category of having just ending up with a protest candidate who takes votes away from the Democrat, and Trump has the higher base probably, right? So it sort of ends up helping. You know, if Andrew Yang runs for president in this forward party, whatever they're calling it, you know, that helps Trump. I mean, I don't think he gets many votes ultimately, but whatever he gets is helping Trump. I think there's no Republican defections to Andrew Yang or to other sort of that type of centrist,
yeah.
I suspect.
Yeah, or Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin's more popular among Republicans than he is among Democrats.
Maybe
so
the
Joe
other
Manchin
way.
Runs, and he takes more votes away from Trump, and he helps Biden. Yeah, I mean, it's a curious dynamic if you start thinking through the kinds of people who would run as third-party candidates, and the effect could be the exact opposite of what they're trying to have.
Right, no, that's an important point. Final point, but question maybe on the. Since Biden, you know, did ride to the rescue there, and they ended up with a moderate Democratic candidate who could win in 2020. But he hasn't. Whether he's governed from the left, how much he has, he certainly, I think, is a question. But he certainly hasn't taken on the left. I guess is maybe one way of saying it. He might be most of his policies might be reasonably sane and moderate. Most of the members of that House who were Democrats, a lot of them are pretty moderate in practice, but they haven't really distinguished themselves from the left of the party, and it certainly, I think, has helped convey the impression that the party is, the energy's on the left and all that, and maybe it is to some degree. But
yeah, I was just going to say, he played footsie with Build Back Better Bill for months on end, you know. It was pretty clear Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema were not going to go to this massive, big Build Back Better bill, and yet he delayed passage of the infrastructure bill, which actually was a bipartisan achievement that he could have gone on the road and sold to rural America. We're going to bring you broadband with this bill. Instead, he played footsie with the left on it and ended up raising liberal expectations before dashing them and making the people who voted for Joe Biden as a center-left moderate feel like they've been sold a bill of goods.
Yeah, that was key, wasn't it? I sort of underestimated myself at the time, as I kind of just assumed, well, I mean, it's just a matter of timing when they get through and all. But I think the willingness to hold the infrastructure bill hostage and to look and to keep the national conversation to the degree it was focused on the Hill, on legislation, on the big Build Back Better bill, really, really damaged by that, plus Afghanistan,
really,
I suppose. You know, that's
you know, I think one of the big problems was probably in February of 2021 when Biden met with all these historians who talked about, you know, being a transformative president in the lines of FDR and LBJ. And the thing about historians, I love reading history, but they're not mathematicians. And if you look at the margins that LBJ had and FDR had in both the House and the Senate, there were 2-1 majorities as opposed to an even split. And you can do things when you have 2-1 majorities that you can't do when it's an even split. Abigail Spanberger, the centrist Democratic congresswoman from Virginia, had it exactly right. Nobody elected him to be FDR. They elected him to be normal and stop the chaos. And she had it exactly right. And if he had governed as a guy to be normal and stop the chaos, rather than somebody who had designs on being this transformative liberal president, I think his job approval would probably be 10 or 15 points higher now than it is today.
Yeah, that's really an interesting thought experiment. And I suppose people around him were telling me, you can't offend the left because we have a very fragile coalition. But of course, it's a bit of a paradox. I mean, by tolerating and humoring the left because it's only a 50% coalition, you decrease the chances of it getting to be more than a 50% coalition, right? I mean, there's a funny way. You have to take the risk of alienating the extremes in your own party to make your party bigger in a way. Is that right? I think that is
right. That's right. That's exactly right. And most politicians don't want to do that or don't try to do that.
Yeah.
But it would be interesting to see if we could actually elect somebody who tried to govern within shouting distance of the center and see how that worked out.
Yeah. Well, that would be a good thing to do. Okay. We'll work on that for the next 2 years. Anything I haven't covered with that we should talk about, or we've laid out the landscape? Not entirely an encouraging one, but
The only other thing I'd add is some changes in voting rules for primaries that might help to get some candidates that are closer to the center nominated. Jungle primaries with the top two or three or four candidates going into a general election or a runoff. Second choice voting has the possibility of elevating people who are closer to the center and eliminating people who are more on the extremes. We're going to have a test of that in in Alaska here in a couple of weeks. We've got a runoff with three candidates. They were supposed to be the top four, but a third candidate dropped out with Mary Pottola, who's a Democrat, and two Republicans, Nick Begich and Sarah Palin. You could have a situation, because you got two Republicans and one Democrat, where a Democrat ends up governing a very Republican state. On the other hand, if Nick Begich can come in second, I think he'll get the second place votes that went to Sarah Palin, and then he could end up winning and Sarah Palin losing. So it's going to be a very, very interesting thing to watch. There were 48 candidates who ran in the special election in Alaska for Congress. One of whom, including, believe it or not, was Santa Claus. And Santa Claus got 5% of the vote to go to Congress. So I don't know how Santa Claus could lose in Alaska, but
yeah, that's terrible. I mean, that's a bad sign for America. It's the war on Christmas, you know. Trump was right. It's they need to fix that.
Yep.
But no, I think the congressional race and the Murkowski Senate race in Alaska will be an interesting test of the ranked choice voting and the jungle primary action as well. I mean, California and Washington State have the jungle primary, and it looks like in Washington State, two people who voted to impeach Trump have survived, which Meyer didn't in Michigan. Because it was a multi-candidate primary, they got in the top two. One of them may not win, I think, in November, but they beat back. Now, the Trump opposition was also split, so one could be careful about, one has to be careful about drawing too many implications from one or two elections. But the big advantage of the electoral reform is it doesn't require a magic change in the Constitution, the Electoral College. It doesn't require even overcoming the two-party system in the short term. It just requires pretty doable changes. They exist in some states, as we've just been talking about. New York City mayor race was run on ranked choice voting. And pretty maybe achievable changes, more achievable changes that could do some good in moderating and combating, I suppose, the polarization. So yeah, I'm glad you mentioned those. And
leave at least a ray of hope here.
Yeah, well, that's good. We should always leave people with not too much hope, but a ray of hope. Whit, thank you for joining me today.
Surely, Bill. My pleasure.
No, it was really an interesting conversation, I think. And thank you, Whit Ayres, and thank you all for joining us on Conversations.